I've just read the latest New Scientist article on which of the planet's two preferred forms of photosynthesis, C3 and C4, is going to fare the best with the increasing levels of carbon dioxide being belched out by the USA and China, and obviously the rest of the world, a bit of world transport. I suppose the issue is that scientists have thought, laid a bet on one of them, and found that looks the story's a bit more complicated. And there's a little bit of information there. There's sort of the assumption that you will know what C3 and C4 is, and a little bit of the things that an educated science reader will now know what that is. And there's another interesting article, I think, in the week before about how scientists are having a little bit of a rethink about the acidification of oceans and of fresh water and salt water. And again, there's a sort of a general assumption, a level of science literacy, also mixed with a level of simplification, which actually breeds article after article. So you have to read a whole lot of articles to get a general view. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. And in this, I'm just going to give you a little tour of a non-expert's view on the topic, where I've slowly picked up points over the years, bits that I've understood, and obviously photosynthesis is very interesting, because this is where the sunlight comes in and plants produce food, and we eat the food and breathe the oxygen and we live our lives. It's quite important. There is a general, so there's heaps of assumptions in there, which we'll slowly work through. I suppose the key thing is the instant view is you have the idea of someone keeping warm, boiling a kettle, inefficiently burning coal or a cowpat or whatever it is, belching out carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. You also have the idea of cows eating grass and belching out or farting out methane. So you've got all those greenhouse gases going up there. So that's something that we tend to know about. And in a previous podcast, I told you the amazing fact that besides carbon dioxide keeping the heat into the surface, it's also a key agent in coupling our atmosphere to the deep cold of space. So if you feel chilly, that's also the carbon dioxide working. So there's a few aspects of that. Again, with cows eating grass and kangaroos eating grass, one produces methane, the other one doesn't. The kangaroos are our methane-free ones. Because the cows are using cells, the first cells, the ancient cells, and they're alive and well in cow's stomach, and they're eating up the food, or converting the food into small molecules, and one of the smaller molecules it produces is methane. There's that aspect of looking about what's going on here. So the idea is that plants will come to their rescue, will plant big forests, will green the Sahara Desert, we can win the day. And this is where an article will state that, and then you sort of recall, oh look, there's some other carbon dioxide sinks which are at play here. One is obviously the oceans. The oceans, for some reason, are absorbing a lot of the carbon dioxide, and also weathering. So if you the actual amount of weathering and erosion exposes fresh rocks, and that locks up a substantial amount of carbon dioxide permanently. So again, we're getting a picture that if you read a simple article, C3, C2, two grades of photosynthesis, that will have an impact, it's sort of implied it'll have a big impact on the sinking of carbon dioxide. And then it's, when you come to think of it, it's a more complex story coming along. And so this article said, we're expecting, I can't even remember, C3 or C4 to improve more with the increased carbon dioxide, but no, it didn't. And sort of you scratch your head when you actually read this a bit. I suppose I think C4, there's more carbons in it. So the 3 and the 4 represents the number of key carbons in a chain, and in the photosynthesis process. So we'll go back into it. So essentially, photosynthesis in overview is a light comes in and hits a chlorophyll molecule in a group of a cell containing chlorophyll, and it has chloroplasts. So that's the molecules, and that creates precursors which go around. Now, in this, in simplified story, we say, look, that the light comes in and directly produces absorbs carbon dioxide and water, sticks those together, casts off oxygen and produces glucose. So just a little aside, this is a simplified version. A little aside, when I'm first teaching this, I tend to get black Play-Doh and roll them in balls for the carbon dioxide, for the carbon, white Play-Doh for the oxygen, so stick two balls either side of that and produce 6 carbon dioxide Play-Doh molecules, and then I produce 6 water, that's white oxygens and little pink, tiny pink molecules for the hydrogen, and then I get the students to get this all together and then pick off the oxygens and stick on the water to the carbon. So that's a hydrogen, a carbon, an OH, and then to stick those carbons in a ring, and they have made a glucose molecule, just very, very roughly. And the students definitely remember that technique, but it's, as we'll find out, it's a bit more complicated than that. But they go away with memorising that light comes in, you get carbohydrate out, and oxygen out, I can see it, and the starting products were just water and carbon and carbon dioxide. So it's a very flat level, school level. Obviously, as you're churning through these articles, you start to think a little bit more. All right, so I suppose as a molecular physicist was interested in the actual how the energy came in the light and how it was stored in the chloroplast, the chlorophyll molecule, and that's one of the things I'm interested in is the dye reception, the colour that it absorbs that, how it stores the energy and how it transfers it to electrons or to molecules, and how that goes forward. So that's something that I'm interested in. I'm also interested in similarly about the heme molecule. You know, how does that actually put the brakes on an oxygen and carry it around? Or the I've forgotten what the actual sister molecule, sister protein in the blood, globular protein, carbolase, which promotes the acidification of the blood with carbon dioxide much more than it does normally with water. So those two, the heme and the carbolase, work together, to transport oxygen in and the other one to dissolve and release carbon dioxide out. And there's a chemistry of that. Now, looking into it, I found that there's no reward in it. I wasn't doing it for a consultation or anything like that. It was a general interest. There were bits that I understood, but it quickly became almost incomprehensible. You had energy membranes, complicated exchanges, and you were producing molecules which were a long way from the glucose. So it wasn't that simple process. On the other hand, looking at the light coming in, you had the riddle that the peak of the solar spectrum around green or yellow coming in wasn't being used by plants. That's right. The plants are ignoring this light and shining it towards you. That's why they look green. So the one colour of light that is not used is green. So you could do as a school experiment getting various colour spectrum of light, a red, green and a blue shone on a plant, shone on individual plants and see how they fare. You would find that plants which have only green light on them actually don't photosynthesize. And of course, the green light is the light that plants reject. And so you've got this problem. And again, reading deeply into it, we are the we're the beneficiaries of a solution to a problem which no longer exists. So back with the ancient bacteria, sorry, the ancient cells photosynthesizing, originally photosynthesized with green light, and therefore, because they were absorbing green, looked purple or blue. So you get your blue-green algae, which is in ponds today, and that's because it's the efficient old way. So that's majority of light, majority of energy is in green, and it meant that for the next photosynthesis, next generation photosynthesis to survive, the only niche, spectral niche, remembering that this is all waterborne, there's very little surface that you can climb up to. So the only light penetrating into the ocean wasn't green light, it was the other lights. So the plants have evolved chlorophyll, which are sort of an ancient bacteria, and that ancient bacteria was hanging around. So you had the ancient cells, and then the bacteria came along, and then the eukaryotic or nuclear cells created a combined thing. They decided to harvest the photosynthesizing bacteria, which were green chlorophyll, and the chlorophyll were slave bacteria, like mitochondria today in animals. A slave bacteria in these eukaryotic or nuclear cells, with the nucleus, they're the more advanced cells, and they're the cells which came onto land, and essentially they created basic little oceans in their leaves. And so when you're looking at the leaves today, they're little oceans. The oceans of old have been recreated, lovingly recreated. Water is collected, and everything is collected for these chlorophyll. Now, amazingly, in leaf cells, the chlorophyll can actually swim around in the leaf cells. And so if you shine a light on one corner, the chlorophylls can actually swarm and move up, migrate in these ancient seas. So they're chlorophyll, they're living the life, luxury life as slaves, and so they've been carried around. I suppose they have separate DNA, similar to the way that mitochondria has separate DNA from the the nucleus of plant cells. So plant cells do have a nucleus, you know, and just while we're on the DNA of chlorophyll, here we can actually do a family tree, and we can see that plants have been evolving solutions, and that photosynthesis and various forms of photosynthesis have evolved not once but dozens of times. So there's a continual arms race or technology or relation. So it's a bit like mobile phones being produced. You've got your Apple, your Samsung, and whole Nokia, and all these other types of solutions being produced. There's a general same functionality, but a different different origin, design origin going forward. And so we have in this photosynthesis several grades of photosynthesis being produced, and that's C3, C4, and something else which, if you just read the literature, just come across, called CAM. So if you can remember those, C3, C4 and CAM. CAM, I think, stands for, look, I'm not an expert, I've just read this, and I just have the basic understanding to start to read an article and put things in their boxes. So C3 says there's an important component in the photosynthesis process, which has three carbons in a line. C4 is something different, it's got four carbons in a line. And then CAM is again someone else's name. And so it's now obviously the aim of this podcast to start adding some basic information for you to take away with. Now, the process of making a sugar from carbon dioxide, water and sunlight is the same in all plants, C3, C4 and CAM. In fact, all plants use light and convert it to sugar, you know, sun food, by the C3 process. And C4 is not a replacement of C3, it's actually a efficiency feed-in process which sits on top of C3. And CAM is actually a, physiological, another process which sits on top of it. So if you can imagine your C3 plants have evolved, and C4 is like an extra, I think it's been like, I remember seeing a documentary, it's like a turbocharger, and CAM is a efficiency turbocharging management system. There you go, turbocharger management system, which all sits on top of it. So everything uses the C3 process. And again, forgive me, I really pronunciation of some of these things. I've never had to speak with other people. I've just read it. I'm just doing this podcast as a rehabilitation, sort of relaxing talk through a data dump of something. So you read it. So coming back, you read an article, and you speak with other people, and they just have never been worried. They've read other articles, the same articles as you, but the sort of contradictions between them hasn't worried, or they just sort of haven't checked things up. So let's get on to the C3. So 100% of your plants use C3. So the three plants that I'm going to get you to think about are your Canadian maple. That's a veined plant. So if you want to show your students a vein plant, there's these leaf miners, which go in some of these more exotic Australian plants. The big plants with these big, huge leaves, the leaf miner comes in and it shows you the beautiful vein system inside plants. So this is a crossed vein, like your maple leaf is a thing. Then you've got your grass, which you can pick up, and or your, in some cases, your palms are like this. It's essentially a grass or a palm. You can pinch off the top and rip right down because the vascularity is all in lines. It's all arranged in lines. I've just got to think. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just going in my head because grasses tend to be monocotyledon, which means they've got big spray roots, whereas carrots definitely... okay. Carrots and celery. You've got to really think. There's lots of pracs you can do with carrots and celery and grass. Basic things to explore. Right. So we're just going through the types of three iconic plants representing the C3 for the maple, C4 the grass, and for your cam is your cactus. Your little prickly pear cactus. And prickly pear is an interesting story in itself about the potential the Achilles heels of cactus and how that was removed and then replaced in Australia. So just a very short thing. Someone had a beautiful cactus called a prickly pear, which is like a pear, if you like it, with prickles on it, and released it in Australia. And it went bananas. It actually began to choke out all Australian life until someone said, let's bring in the cactoblastis moth. And the moths came around and ate it. And so you still see a few prickly pears every once in a while, sitting on the side of a field or something like that. But that gives you the idea that the cam process, which sits on the C4 process, which sits on top of the C3 process, that's got all the solutions, the growing solutions are in there, but it's got, it's at the end of the day, there's a moth at the end of that evolutionary path eating it all up, so it would be quite good. So you've got just C3, which is C3 is 100%, it does your maple, your grass and your cactus, so you can just think of that to make it a bit easier. The idea of this podcast is as a stimulus for you to go out and research this. I suppose it'd be on Wikipedia. There are probably some other sites on it. So your C3 process. So your C3 process is like the molecules have got lots of phosphates and phenols and aromatic compounds. And there's a central protein, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But C3 starts off with a C5, five carbons in a chain, all built up. That's your starter molecule. And if you can imagine a factory or a rotary dairy where cows come in one end and they come out the other, and then milk goes that one way, and you've got a cow going back out. And so your rotary dairy is your... globular protein. So I've mentioned a few globular proteins in the past. The ones that I really got into are the slightly simpler ones in the blood, the albumin, which we've mentioned in the blood before, with all those beautiful disulfide bonds. It's albumin is something which, depending on the environment, I suppose the acidic environment, I don't know quite what the environment is, basically can hoy out all the sodium molecules, and you can flush it out of your kidney. It's a transport molecule. A full 10% of your blood is this globular protein. There's another globular protein, which is the carbon dioxide. A globular protein is your hemoglobin. the heme is for the blood, but the globin is a circular. So this protein's not a single protein. I think it's three or four proteins locked together in a ball. Looks a bit like a tennis ball. And this protein is sort of like a multifunction Swiss Army knife. And it takes the five-chain carbon. So we're just going to reduce it. When I first read it, I really looked in on the things which were hooked onto the carbon. But it hooks, it then takes a single carbon dioxide and puts that carbon dioxide onto the five chain, making a six chain, breaks it up into two, three chains. Oh no, no, that's incorrect. It, with the six chain, it hooks it around and makes a glucose and makes a replacement five chain carbon. You'll have to look into it. I'm not and the name of this, the all important name of this is Rubico. I sort of remember that. I'm just the co stands for carbolase and oxyase. So ase means that if it's got an ase, it means it's a enzyme. That is, it's a molecule which is basically a Swiss Army knife molecule, a tool molecule. And carbo means it reacts with carbon dioxide, and O means it reacts with oxygen as well. There, just tap it away, the oxase. I really can't remember. Rubico, that's something I do remember. So it goes around and takes the carbon dioxide and produces glucose. So, although the chlorophyll actually produces the precursor, the precursor molecules then have to interact with this enzyme, which then simply takes the carbon dioxide and produces a glucose molecule at the end of it. Obviously, the system has to go around and provide those precursor molecules to come in. So it's 5 plus 1 goes to 6, and the 6 goes to glucose, and there's a whole series of... Oh, yeah, and it's just a cycle, like a circular dairy with the Rubico in the centre, and that's called the Calvin cycle. I'm just going... I think maybe G or C, Calvin cycle. Look, I'm only going off memory here. But the important point about this is C3. So why it's called C3 is that 6 breaks into 3. And so the actual building blocks for your glucose are... I've messed that up. I've sort of mucked it up. So the 5 plus 1 goes to 6, which breaks into 3s. And the 3s go into making glucose. So at a certain point, that 6 gets broken up into 3, and that's called a C3 process. And so looking at this complicated process, they've cottoned in on the point that part of the process after the C6 goes to C3, and they've named the process the C3 process, or the Calvin cycle. C3, I don't know why that is. But the important thing is with this is that this process can be poisoned by oxygen. So if you have too much oxygen in there, it's hard to imagine too much oxygen, this process can just not produce glucose whatsoever. It can just spin out of control, not producing it. And so there's two things which... So it's got two parts. It can be the Rubico for the carbolase, or Rubico for the oxalase. The oxalase process is putting the clutch on your plant, and so it just does all the photosynthesis, and it just spins around just churning around oxygen, saying, I didn't want... and that's called photorespiration. That is, plants can actually use photosynthesis and actually breathe oxygen by mistake. And this is a bad thing. And this is why C3 is a not the greatest process. It's nature's best effort, but it's not the greatest process. And C3 has these problems, that if there's too much oxygen, but also if there's too much heat. So as soon as it gets a little bit hot, these plants start to stop producing as much sugar. So your maple leaf, your maple tree doesn't exist in the desert too well in the hot fields. So there's a process which sits on top of it, and just strap in your imagination for it. So what happens is that in a C3, it's make as many of these photosynthetic cells as possible, get them up there. Now, the Rubico is a protein. It's a fantastic nitrogen, carbon, carbon chain. It's a protein chain. And it's sort of like the equivalent of albumin in the blood. Like it makes a good percentage of a leaf. All the protein in the leaf is basically this protein. It's sort of the major protein that the plant really requires to produce its photosynthetic precursor molecules, grab some carbon dioxide in and actually produce it out. I must admit, I did follow some of the electron exchange and membrane. There's membranes, and this is with the photosynthesis and that make you precursor a molecule. There's membrane potentials. It's something which is just, you just read and go, yep, right, okay. In terms of trying to actually stitch the science into something meaningful, it's much easier to go across to say that photosynthesis produces the precursor molecules. The precursor molecules go in the Calvin cycle, the C3 cycle. C3, again, to repeat it, is your C6 breaks into two and gets restitched together to glucose and gets restitched together to your C5. Obviously, when I think about it, there's things I've forgotten in there. And going in this C3 cycle is great for a cold planet, great for the planet when it had heaps of carbon dioxide. So earlier on in the Carboniferous period, or when there's been huge amounts of volcanism. That's one thing I should mention. We've got the wildfires on Earth and human activity. There's also volcanic activity, which is notoriously variable, but when this volcanic activity really kicks off, it can really restart, re-inject carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So the plants, besides humans, the plants have really been dealing with times of plenty and times of paucity. And the C4 process is got really nothing to do with using up the photosynthetic precursors. In fact, it doesn't use them whatsoever. What that is, it has C4, and that's in your grasses, your turbochargers. And turbochargers is C4 is all about getting carbon dioxide, putting it into a neat little biscuit of carbon dioxide. A C4, the problem here is I've just Rubico I liked because it's a nice name. Pep carbolase, I've sort of in my head called it Pepsi, and it produces a malt. I've called it a Maltese in my head. I'm sorry, you'll have to go and find the actual real name for it. Malt molecule. So the malt molecule. So the C4 produces these malt molecules, so it gets a... so what it does is it gets a C3 molecule, completely different from the C3 in the Calvin process, and it adds a carbon dioxide to it, and that makes a C4, and then it converts those C4, and this is a large number of them, to the maltase molecule. And so your PEP carbolase, and it's and why it's called carbolase and not carbolase oxalase, it's one of these processes where the plants have worked out this process is no good, here's a much better process, except it doesn't produce glucose, it produces maltase. This maltase is a chemical, it's produced in produced, and it's pumped in little tubes to the photosynthetic bacteria, photosynthetic cells, the rubicose cells. The rubicose cells still have to be exposed to sunlight, but they're given exclusive control of water, because it gets water, and the carbon dioxide, pure carbon dioxide gas, is plumbed into them. So there you go. The grass is got plumbing in it. So the photosynthetic cells are kept away from the oxygen, kept away from the air, and they have little tubes going to them, little breathing tubes which go into them with carbon dioxide. And so this works really well, because Rubico process, which is heat sensitive, still heats. It's the same process, still heat sensitive. Where it's poisoned by oxygen, oxygen's kept away from it, and so your carbon dioxide and your light go in, and oxygen's kept away from it, and so these little cells, the Calvin cycle is hidden away from the oxygen, so they put the turbocharging C4 cells, PEP carbolase. So PEP carbolase refers to a protein, a enzyme protein, which is in grass. And this means that the grass has evolved in the extremely low carbon environment, but as part of the trick of evolving in low carbon environments, it's evolved to work in relatively more hot, more higher temperature conditions. And so I suppose one of the things the leaves do is they have transpiration, which cools them down. Grass, I don't know whether they have as much transpiration in terms of the way that they're structured. They also evolve for the hotter conditions, and they've evolved in... grass has only evolved recently. It's at this point that we should take a stop and look at some of the other factors coming in to grass. So I'm bringing in other factors because this is what you do as an experienced reader. You've sort of read lots of different articles and recorded things, and then we have a whole heap of other different people coming in here. You've got your students who want and need a simple story. You've got people who are professional teachers who come in and really focus on the simple story only. We've got a whole heap of people, so I'm one person, this huge spectrum of stuff, and I'm podcasting, and hopefully you're listening and getting to it. So, look, the grass story is a bit more complex than this, in that there's a few aspects of grass. I'm just going off, just recalling articles I've read or things. Grass is designed to burn quickly, cleanly, and regrow really quickly. And that's the eucalypts in Australia have also evolved. I'm sitting underneath something called turpentines, which go up like bombs. Our entire house is surrounded by turpentines, and if If so, the turpentine is also turpentines and eucalypts are basically just putting out this gas of eucalyptus oil. Eucalyptus oil, again, fantastic molecule. Rather than these flat molecules, it's got yet another chain which sticks out in three dimensions and links it across the turpentines, terps, and eucalyptus oil. These fantastic, really interesting molecules here. But these are evolved to basically blow up. So in a hot fire with the eucalyptus, eucalyptus really stress and start emitting a mist of explosive eucalyptus oil. Just they literally, there is this huge roar when in a bushfire, and especially on the canopies, the canopy, you can be underneath and just this flame front just bursts over the top of you as these eucalyptus burns. So too grass. Grass is designed to burn really quickly and obviously kill off the other more sedentary C3 plants which are trying to go. And then they're also designed to be eaten. So the top of it can burn and it can, and the roots can be okay and it can start to grow off. So it's a very hot, intense flame, but it burns quickly and leaves the roots alone. And similarly, plants have co-evolved with grazing animals. Grazing animals do great things. They eat things which compete with the grass. They clear away things. They've got tracks. They get grass seeds in them and spread the grass seeds around the place. And then if the fertility is a bit iffy, they have a good old manure, spread their manure around the place. They dig up the soil. You've got, you know, all these things, just, you know, grass. They've got these animals which depend on grass, and they wind up supporting grass